But for us this morning, we threw out the question, right? As far as what types of interruptions bother you the most? You know, what are some that annoy you the most? Maybe at work, at home, you know, when you're in the middle of something. But I want to hear some. Like, throw some out. What types of interruptions bother you guys the most? Anyone? Train? Yeah, having to wait for the train. All right. The alarm. Yeah, the interruption known as the alarm clock. Yes, because you have to wake up now. Anyone else? Child melting down. Yes. Yes. Or child needing diaper changed at the critical moment of the Super Bowl. Right. Right. But well, that's what diapers are for, right? You know, it's not going anywhere, right? It's like, wait it out. Anyone else? Emails from undergraduate. Oh, those, you know, pitiful undergraduates. Yes. Yes. But one of the interruptions that bother me the most is people asking questions during movies. And, you know, like, I love my mom, but my mom does this a lot. And I understand she just wants to figure out what's going on, you know? But I know that if I try to, you know, answer her question, it's going to take a while, and then I'm going to miss part of the movie, and then I'm going to have questions. But, you know, a lot of times I feel like our goal in life is trying to minimize or trying to limit the number of interruptions that we encounter. And it seems like we feel like we can only be efficient or effective or get things done if we're in an environment that doesn't have any interruptions. And I know, you know, as parents, a lot of us that have young kids, especially the moms, you know, you understand this, right? Because, you know, you spend an entire day trying to get one thing done, but because, you know, you can't, because you got these kids that are constantly looking to get your attention, they need snacks, you know, they have meltdowns, or they're just wanting someone to play with. And so, I mean, that's Rachel's life, you know, every day. And, you know, there's something that she might want to get done in the morning, but she can't get to it until late at night once all the kids are sleeping. Or even after the kids are down and we think we're in the clear, there's still interruptions during sleep. You know, with Gabby or Zachary somehow sneak into our bed, or Clementine starts crying and we got to go grab her. So earlier this week, I ran across this really informative and, you know, really accurate diagram. You want to pull it up? So, yeah, so also known as the Kama Sutra for parents. But basically, you got the booby trap on the top left there, where sometimes your wife leaves the baby sleeping on your side of the bed. And if you're not confident that you can't disarm this, you know, crying baby bomb, then you end up in the second position, the doghouse, which I've been before. And then you got the snow angel, the third one there, where the baby's trying to create more space for himself or herself. H is for hell, which that's literally a pain in your back. The bottom one there, you got the Donkey Kong. You can't see it. But, you know, especially for us with a family of three kids, when all three of them in our bed, right, and we're, like, curled up at the foot of our own bed, you know, it's kind of pathetic. You got the jazz hands. And then you got the neck scarf, which I've woken up to many times, you know. Clementine just, like, on my face. And then you've got the last one there, the stalker, which... Right? At 4 a.m., your kid's not sleeping, so you decide to sleep and she can watch you sleep, right? But, you know, that's a pretty accurate portrait of, you know, just the sleep life of parents. And for many of us, you know, we live and we work in an environment of just constant interruptions, you know, whether it's our kids, whether it's emails, you know, phone calls, or our coworkers always dropping by your cubicle, you know, or maybe it's meetings that just get in the way of you actually getting any work done. And so we can't seem to free ourselves from, you know, interruptions. You know, last year, the former CEO of Campbell Soup Company, he wrote this book. It's called Touch Points. And, you know, it was basically from his experience in leadership, his experience as a CEO. And for him, right, he actually suggests that the daily interruptions that leaders face are actually really great leadership opportunities. And so he takes this theory and he applies it for his own company and ends up, you know, changing. He turns his company around and he leads his company to 5 consecutive years of growth. For him, he sees interruptions as a method to actually engage his employees, to let them know about their vision and the agenda. And as a result, it actually leads to, you know, more productive employee relationships, more productive customer relationships, and it actually resulted in, you know, growth and increased revenue. And I wonder for us, you know, if we were maybe to apply that same principle or that same idea in the context of our spiritual formation. You know, maybe perhaps that's how God works. Maybe that's his MO, that in order for us to actually grow and develop, interruptions are required. And I think if we look at that tension, you know, we feel like, well, somehow interruptions seem to take away from our time and our productivity. But at the same time, I think it's actually really important to our process of growth. And so this morning, the passage we're going to look at is going to give us a glimpse into the life of Jesus and just the interruptions that he faced on a daily routine. And hopefully we can learn from his example of how he engaged these interruptions and maybe what it means for us to do the same in our life. So if you've got your Bibles, go ahead and grab a couple people around you. Turn to Mark chapter 1, verses 29 to 39. And just give you some context about what we're going to talk about this morning. So Mark 1, verses 29 to 39. It'll be up on the screen here. So I'll give you a couple minutes to go ahead and read that to each other. All right, so let's pick it up here in verse 29. In verse 29, it says, "As soon as they left the synagogue, they went with James and John to the home of Simon and Andrew." And so they is actually referring to Jesus, you know, and his followers. And at this point, there's only a few disciples, right? These guys are kind of the first few disciples that are starting to follow Jesus. You got James and John, who are brothers. And then you got Simon, who we know better as Peter, and his brother Andrew. And so if we look back at the beginning of this chapter, you see this is actually when Jesus starts his career. And, you know, he's just been baptized by his cousin, John the Baptist, and now he's starting to preach and teach to the crowds. And so there's one day where Jesus walks, he comes along the Sea of Galilee, and he runs into these guys. You know, they're on their boats, they're fixing their nets, they're trying to, you know, catch fish. And we don't get as many details in this version that Mark gives us, but if you look at Luke, his version, his story in Luke 5, you see that basically, you know, Jesus is hanging out on the shore and the crowds start to form because they want to hear him teach. And so Jesus sees Peter and he sees his boat, right? And he says, "Hey, you know, can I use your boat? I kind of want to use it as, you know, a floating stage," right? And so, you know, imagine if like the boat back there, you know, I'm sitting in it, you know, floating, teaching you, right? That'd be kind of what it'd be like. Yeah, probably I couldn't pull that off. But, you know, so now Jesus teaches, and after he's done, he tells Peter to take his boat into the deepest part of the water and to throw his net down to catch some fish. And Peter's like, you know, he's like, "We spent the entire night trying to do that. We spent all night. We didn't catch anything," right? And so for him, this doesn't make sense because, one, you don't fish in the middle of the day. And two, you know, Jesus wasn't really a fisherman. So in his mind, he's thinking, what are you talking about? But he goes ahead and throws the nets down. And what happens is they catch so much fish that their nets start to break. And they actually have to pull in another boat to hold all the fish. And then both boats start to sink because of how much fish there was. And so having witnessed this miracle firsthand, you know, Jesus invites them to come and follow him. And for, you know, James and John, for Peter and Andrew, like the world of fish is all they've known. Like this is what their entire life has been about. And here Jesus is kind of inviting them to interrupt their life's work, you know, to join him in something completely different. And, you know, we've all been through life-changing events, you know, that can be disruptive to our lives. You know, maybe we've moved to a new city, and so we've had to leave friends or family, you know, or leave an established community. And so now we're trying to find our way and trying to plug into a new city. You know, or maybe some of us had to start a new job, and that's an interruption to our career path, you know, and we're forced to start all over and we have to, you know, build our value to this new company. You know, or maybe, you know, getting married, right? And that's an interruption to just how we maybe have functioned as just an individual and just we've only had to think about ourselves. Or for some of us, you know, we've decided to introduce the mini disruptions known as children, right, into our lives, even though they are very cute disruptions. But nothing of these, like, compared to the disruption that Jesus is asking them and inviting them into. And, you know, people responded very differently to his invitation, right? You had people that obviously did follow him, but then you had some people that saw his invitation as a really inconvenient interruption, you know, to their life, to their responsibilities. You know, there was one guy that, you know, talked to Jesus. He said, you know, I want to follow you, but I need to go back home first and bury my father, right? Which back in that culture, it was just another way to say, you know, I've got a dad who's getting old, but I need to take care of him until he dies. And so, you know, however long that took, it could be indefinite. And so really it was more of a cop-out. It was an excuse that the guy was giving. But there's another guy who also said similar. He said, you know, I want to follow you, but let me go home first and say goodbye to my family. Right? That somehow maybe he saw this as just a temporary interruption. You know, he still had his eyes back on something. And Jesus responded to him and said, hey, you know, no one can look back and be fit to serve in the kingdom of heaven. And then there was the other guy that Jesus told, hey, you need to sell all your stuff, sell your possessions, give everything to the poor, and then follow me. And the guy couldn't do it, right? He couldn't let go of his wealth. He couldn't let go of his stuff. And if we look throughout Scripture, you know, we see that God disrupts. He likes to interrupt when people aren't living the way they're intended to live. You know, you see it with the Tower of Babel, you know, when God kind of confuses everyone and introduces new languages. You see it with the flood. You know, God wants to start over because there's too much evil in the world. You know, you see it with, you know, sending Israel into exile, into a foreign country, you know, because they couldn't keep their covenant with God. But not that, only that, but, you know, God also interrupts individual people's lives, right? In order to move them into a direction, to get them into, you know, what he's doing. You know, you got someone like Abraham, who God basically tells him to pack up his family and just move to where he's going to tell him. He doesn't give him a specific place. He just says, I'll show you where you're going to move. But he was able to obey, and as a result, you know, he became the father of the nation of Israel. You know, or someone like Joseph, whose, you know, young childhood got interrupted when his, you know, devious brothers sell him into slavery. You know, but God needed him in Egypt to be an influence in that empire, and eventually actually to save his own family from a future famine. Or even someone like Mary, right, that in her teenage years, she gets interrupted, and God interrupts her life by giving her this baby because she's going to give birth to Jesus. And when God interrupts our lives, a lot of times it's to move us, you know, from where we're consumed and to bring us to a place where we can actually be a part of his story. And, you know, for me, you know, I spent my college years studying electrical engineering. You know, after college, I started work. I worked at Accenture doing technology consulting. And, you know, did a lot of traveling, you know, had a lot of big clients, ate a lot of good food, gained some good weight. And, you know, isn't that environment of security and comfort, you know, being able to kind of develop this career. And it was in that that I was presented with an opportunity, you know, to be part of a church plant, to, you know, maybe help lead this church plant. And, you know, just to see if I'd be willing to be a part of what God's doing here in Austin. And, you know, going on with the church plant, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty. There's a lot of unknowns. You know, there's a lot of heartache. There's a lot of pain. There's a lot of trial involved. And it wasn't an easy choice. You know, but for me, I realized I had to leave behind what my idea of comfort and security meant. And I just had to trust that being a part of God's story was far more important than that. And I think for us, you know, what are some things maybe that God's stirring up in your life? You know, what are some things that maybe God's interrupting because you need to be in a different place or you need to be living in a different way? And, you know, it doesn't have to be those huge life-changing things. I mean, I think a lot of times God interrupts us in the little things, you know, just serve as reminders, maybe of just, you know, our character, things that we need to work on. Or maybe activities or environments that we need to let go of and leave behind and not look back at. And the invitation to follow him is meant to be interruptive. It's meant to disrupt our lives so that we can participate in his story. And then we continue in verse 30. It says, Simon's mother-in-law was in bed with a fever, and they immediately told Jesus about her. So he went to her, took her hand and helped her up. The fever left her, and she began to wait on them. First of all, it's kind of interesting that Peter's married. Like, I don't know. For some reason, I always thought the disciples were like bachelors. You know, there's a bunch of guys, you know, just sitting around, just hanging out, just following Jesus where he went. But apparently he's married. He actually mentions, his wife gets mentioned later in 1 Corinthians too, and she actually joins him on all these missionary trips. So this decision actually for Peter to follow Jesus was even more disruptive because he actually had a family that he was responsible for. But we see here that Peter's mother-in-law, she has a fever. And I think we might miss that impact a bit, you know, because today if we hear someone has a fever, it's like, you know, just pop a couple Advil, you know, sleep it off, you'll be fine. But back in those days, having a fever was a very serious condition, right? They didn't have medicine, they didn't have, you know, antibiotics, and potentially having a fever, you know, would lead to death. You know, for Rachel and I, we've actually had a heightened awareness when it comes to fever for our own kids, especially with Zachary. So a few years back when he was four, we had just moved into East Austin here, and one of the Vox houses in the neighborhood, they were throwing a big Halloween party, you know, just to, you know, get the neighbors and the kids that were coming by. So, you know, we got this huge moonwalk for the kids to jump on. We had, you know, carnival games. We had, you know, face painting. We had, you know, burgers and hot dogs and everything. And I kid you not, literally, Zachary was in that moonwalk for like 3 hours straight, like nonstop, you know, just jumping. Which one was pretty impressive, but two, it was actually a really bad idea because that week he had been sick and he'd been coughing a lot. And so when we get home, he actually got, you know, he started getting a fever and it went through the night, you know, he just had a really rough night sleeping. And then the morning he didn't get any better. And that morning, at one point, Rachel actually walked past his door and saw that he started having a seizure because he was just so hot. And so, you know, we didn't know what to do. So we brought him to the bathroom. We thought maybe we need to put him in the bathtub to cool him down. But we made the mistake of putting him on his back, which you're not supposed to do when you have a seizure. And he started choking. He couldn't breathe. He started turning blue. And we were freaking out. We didn't know what to do. We realized we need to turn him over. We called 911. You know, the paramedics came. And at this point, 15 minutes had passed, and he was still in a seizure. And the paramedics said, "That's not good. That's not good," you know. And so they pumped him with Valium, and it finally stopped the seizure. And so they brought him, you know, to the hospital. And, you know, apparently he had pneumonia, but they couldn't really figure out why he was having a seizure and what was causing this. And, you know, the doctor said that he might be out for a few hours at least. And so, you know, for us just waiting there, you know, in that moment, not really knowing what was happening, not knowing if there was maybe permanent damage because of this prolonged seizure, you know, it really gave us perspective. You know, for us, that was an interruption in our life. You know, for God to really, you know, for us to kind of look at our priorities, to look at how we were as parents. But, you know, later on that night, Zachary finally woke up. and then the first thing he sees is this, like, light sensor on his finger that's, like, it's monitoring his vitals. And so he wakes up, he sees it, and he goes, pew, 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 right? We're like, oh, he's back, right? He's good. you know, and what's funny is actually the only thing he really remembers about that whole experience was that he got to ride in an ambulance, right? Even though he doesn't remember being in it. But it's like, you know, afterwards he told everyone, he's like, yeah, I got pneumonia and I got to ride in an ambulance, you know? As if, like, that's his prize for getting pneumonia, right? That's your reward. And he wouldn't stop talking about it. Like, I want to go back in an ambulance again, you know? Like, well, buddy, you know, if you ride an ambulance, that's really usually not a good thing. You know, you don't want to be in an ambulance. And so for us, you know, even though he's fully healed, you know, anytime he gets a fever now, like, we get really worried. You know, something kind of triggers in our mind. And so for, you know, Peter's mother-in-law now, right, she has this fever that potentially is life-threatening. And, you know, so they interrupt Jesus' plans for the night, and they tell him, hey, you know, she's got this fever. We need you to see if you can help her out. And so, you know, Jesus goes and sees her, and he just simply lifts her up, you know, helps her sit up, and then the fever leaves, right? There's this complete, immediate healing, right? Because we read that right after this, you know, she starts serving the guests, you know, she kind of resumes her role as host of the home. And, you know, for her, it's as if, you know, nothing really affected her. She just kind of carried on. But what's interesting is if you look at the words that Mark uses to describe this miraculous healing. You know, the passage where it says that, you know, he helped her up. you know, or he lifted her up. The word that Mark actually uses there is raised. And the Greek word there is actually the same word that's very similar to resurrection. And then later when he mentions that the fever left her, the word that Mark actually uses there is released, that she was released from her fever, right? And that word released that he used is actually the same word that typically is used for forgiveness. And so what Mark is doing here, he's trying to communicate these ideas of resurrection and forgiveness, you know, in this act of healing. That somehow he's giving future insight into the type of healing that Jesus is going to be bringing, you know, that it's not just this physical restoration, but there's this spiritual, holistic restoration. And maybe for some of us, you know, we're in need of healing. You know, maybe we're in need of restoration, needing to experience, you know, this resurrection that Christ offers. And having, you know, whatever darkness or burdens or whatever sins just released and removed from our lives so that we can actually experience his forgiveness. And, you know, I think that's what his offer is when he invites people to come and follow him, right? It involves resurrection and forgiveness. And so now Jesus has completely restored Peter's mother-in-law, right? And so now word's kind of gotten out and things get a bit crazy, right? In verse 32, it says, that evening after sunset, the people brought to Jesus all the sick and demon-possessed. The whole town gathered at the door, and Jesus healed many who had various diseases. He also drove out many demons, but he would not let the demons speak because they knew who he was. And so, you know, this is an interruption of a huge proportion, right? Literally the whole town is at the door, right? And historians say that, you know, it's probably around 1,000 to 2,000 people that were living in the city of Capernaum at this time, right? So imagine, you know, the Paramount Theater, right? Holds maybe, you know, 1,300 people. So imagine a sold out Paramount, right? But all those people now show up at your front door. And that's the scene, you know, that Jesus sees in front of him, that these people are waiting for him to heal them, waiting, you know, to be cared for. And, you know, for Jesus, right, this happens, you have to keep in mind, this happens after the sun goes down, right? So this is going to be an extremely long night, and yet he embraces this interruption. He goes and he heals, you know, people that are broken, that are isolated, you know, that are marginalized because of their condition. And, you know, when those who are hurt or broken, you know, come across our path, that's, you know, an opportunity for an interruption in our lives if we're willing to engage them, if we're willing to walk and support them, if we're willing to care for them. And maybe we need to ask ourselves, you know, who are the people that interrupt us, that need healing? You know, maybe they're people that we've known for a long time. Maybe they're, you know, certain family members, or maybe they're friends that we know that are going through a lot of issues. You know, or maybe they're just strangers, people that we don't know that just need care and support. And I know a lot of times, you know, we get jaded or maybe we're burnt out. And so we tend to avoid, you know, engaging and encountering these people because we know there's a cost. We know there's a cost that's associated with it. You know, there's going to be a time cost. There's an emotional cost. You know, there's a cost of, you know, just the risk of being hurt ourselves. You know, this is what Mother Teresa has written on her wall at one of her children's homes. And it's based on the Paradoxical Commandments that was written by a guy named Kent Keith. And this is what it says. It says, people are unreasonable, illogical, and self-centered. Love them anyway. If you do good, people may accuse you of selfish motives. Do good anyway. If you're successful, you may win false friends and true enemies. Succeed anyway. The good you do today may be forgotten tomorrow, but do good anyway. Honesty and transparency make you vulnerable. Be honest and transparent anyway. What you spend years building may be destroyed overnight. Build anyway. People who really want help may attack you if you help them. Help them anyway. Give the world the best you have, and you may get hurt. Give the world your best anyway. You know, in encountering, you know, hurting people, it is an interruption, you know, in your day, in your schedule, for your energy. And they may not repay you. They may even, in turn, hurt you somehow. But that's the compassion of Christ. You know, that's the love that doesn't hold on to any conditions. You know, to love despite inconvenience. And when you look throughout, you know, the life of Jesus, right, it's filled with these constant interruptions, you know, of people wanting to be healed, people wanting to tell him their story of hurt and brokenness. And if you did an assessment on his life, I mean, you know, the good majority of it is probably just responding to these interruptions. And we see that almost, you know, he never turns down any request for help or healing, you know, regardless of the timing, regardless of how inconvenient it might be. But there are a few times that he does turn down specific requests for help. There's one guy that actually asked Jesus to help him kind of deal with this issue that he and his brother had with their, you know, family inheritance. And Jesus didn't engage that. There was another guy who asked Jesus for him. He wanted to, you know, travel with Jesus, but Jesus told him not to, instead to go back home. And we see another example of this here right in Mark in verse 36, right? And says that Simon and his companions went to look for him. And when they found him, they exclaimed, "Everyone is looking for you." But Jesus replied, "Let us go somewhere else, to the nearby villages, so I can preach there also. That is why I've come." And so he traveled throughout Galilee, preaching in their synagogue and driving out the demons. Right? So it's interesting that, you know, he actually has another opportunity here. Right, there are a lot of people that are waiting for him, and yet he chooses not to engage this interruption. You know, it shows that he actually has some discernment, right? And he's not just defaulting to responding to every single interruption that he comes across. And he chooses, in this case, to move on, to not engage this one. And why is that? Right, I think he's able to make this decision to move on because of what happens right before this. You know, in verse 35, it said that very early in the morning, while it was still dark, Jesus got up, he left the house, and went off to a solitary place where he prayed. And remember, right, this is right after that first night of, you know, caring and healing for essentially the whole town, right? And even though there was this crazy intense night, the next morning, while it was still dark, Jesus got up, and he spent time in solitude and prayer. Right, he intentionally interrupted his own schedule, right, to make prayer a priority. And prayer, you know, really is the only way to listen, to really discern how we should respond, you know, to the interruptions that we face each day. You know, Paul writes to the Thessalonians to pray at all times, right, to pray without stopping. And maybe for us, you know, we need to purposely interrupt our day, purposely interrupt our schedule, you know, to find a way to incorporate a rhythm of prayer. And, you know, in doing that, that helps us. Maybe it's just as simple as, you know, each morning asking God to give us awareness, give us discernment of how to handle these interruptions that we face. You know, or maybe it's, you know, our midweek group and using that as a way to interrupt the flow and pattern of our week to where we can pray with our group to really hear what God's saying to us through Scripture. And so this morning, as we close off, you know, rather than just talk about how prayer should impact our ability to encounter these people that interrupt us, I want us to actually practice the prayer of examine. And for those of you who are unfamiliar with this exercise, it's a daily spiritual exercise that Saint Ignatius started centuries ago. Just as a way for us to reflect on our day, to really see, you know, where God is, his presence, where the Spirit is moving throughout our day. And so I'll walk us through this exercise. And so if you go ahead and, you know, sit in a comfortable position, you know, relax, maybe even close your eyes.